Good day, everyone. My name is March Twisdale, and you're listening to my 2019 Encore series of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. This show is recorded in the studios of Voice of Vashon and airs at 11 a.m. every Saturday and 12 noon every Monday on your favorite station, 101.9 FM, KVSH. Thank you for making Voice of Vashon and Prose, Poetry, and Purpose a part of your day. On a more personal note, you may know that in December of 2018, I lost my dad. And my 2019 Encore series is dedicated to his success as a parent. For 46 years, my dad inspired me, and each Encore presentation will include a short story about how he impacted my life with some of my dad's favorite music at the end of the show. So today I want to talk a little bit about how much fun you can have without spending any money. And I will acknowledge that I spent most of my childhood growing up in sort of the coastal, central, southern edge of California state. So yes, the weather was usually pretty comfortable, but you could live somewhere like Montana and do the same thing my dad did. It would just be slightly different. Essentially, I can't remember ever going to a restaurant with my dad, and I only went to one movie ever, and that was to see Star Wars when I was 6 years old, and it came out, and we went to see it on the big screen. Most of the time, spending time with my dad was this thing that I really loved to do. And I want to share for all those dads out there that want their kids to want to spend time with them what it was that made my dad so much fun to hang out with. My dad played with me, and he played all sorts of things. We might go to the beach and play in the ocean, or we might play frisbee, or we might stay home. You know, it does get cold and rainy sometimes, or dreary, even in Santa Barbara, California. And if we stayed home, it was literally time spent doing things that I would enjoy as a child. We had a couple of games, Parcheesi and Monopoly. And at one point we had a game called Sorry. And there was always checkers, and I think a chessboard, and cards. And it was just so much fun to settle down and play games. Now, from his perspective, it was relaxing and it was free. And obviously it was fun because we would all just bust a gut. Like, I can't tell you how many times we would be laying there on the carpeted floor in our rental apartment with, you know, a game of Monopoly or whatever it was out in front of us. And literally all of us, if it was me, my dad, my stepmom, my brothers, or some mixture of, would like be holding our stomachs, crying because we were laughing so hard that our stomachs were starting to hurt because our muscles were clenching up. It was just complete bliss. And it didn't cost a penny. So I wanted to put that out there because a lot of times parents believe that they need to have the ability to spend money in order to be able to do a good job of raising their kids. And while money is very important for heat and food and clothing and medical care, the reality is that my dad's attitude about being a non-consumer and about being a liberated individual, a free-thinking person who wasn't caught up in trying to keep up with the Joneses or whatever that type of thing is, made it so that he actually felt like it was the better choice to entertain ourselves in a way that didn't require us to engage in the economic hamster wheel. Not only was it literally tons of fun, but it was actually sort of a statement or a declaration of independence from all the people out there who want to sell you stuff for their own benefit, not for your benefit. So I hope all of you will just take some time to look around your world and remember all of the people who have lived on this planet before the invention of money, and all the people who lived great lives after money was invented, even though they didn't have a bunch of it in their own pocket. And there's this old saying, I think I saw it on a postcard related to Hawaii. It said something like, you know, you can become wealthy by earning more money or by needing less as well. And now, let's move on to the interview from a few years ago that I have brought back to the airwaves and want to share with all of you. So have a good time and thank you for listening. During the next hour, I'll be talking with Jane Valencia, harpist, artist, and writer extraordinaire, about her novel, Because of the Red Fox. Plus, this month, I'll be offering a new surprise tidbit at the end of the show. So stick around. And now, Jane, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, March. I'm really excited to be here today.
So, Jane, you have an interesting story of being on the island because you were sort of here and then you weren't and then you were again. Why don't you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, well, we moved up here originally to have a lifestyle change. We wanted to check out of Bay Area corporate world and a lot of driving around and live in on an island and in a rural community. And so it was definitely a big shift for us to do that. And once we moved here, it was better than I even dreamed. It was really found it indeed to be a magical place.
Mm-hmm.
But after a while, maybe about 10 years, we kind of, I don't know, got some wanderlust and thought maybe we want to go more remote or maybe we want to do something different. And so we basically sold our house and put everything in storage and went away to try and figure out where that next place would be and ended up in Northeast Oregon for 9 months, but found that to be too remote for me. And then ended up in the Bay Area again, where we both grew up, my husband and I, and were there for family reasons.
Yeah, well, the Bay Area, I mean, I grew up in California, and I haven't been down a while, but every time I do go down, I find it to be so much more crowded. How mm-hmm. was it? I mean, you guys have been gone for over 10 years. Was it right. a bit of a shock?
Well, it was kind of a culture shock coming from Northeast Oregon, especially, which is
oh, right.
was really remote. It had 8,000 people in the whole county. And mm-hmm. So that was a real jolt to actually go into some place like Whole Foods and have this abundance. So it was actually not as jarring as I was expecting it to be. Mm-hmm. Mostly it was an opportunity to reconnect with our community in a different way.
Right.
And so...
But you didn't stay.
We didn't stay, but we had decided... Even before we moved down, it was sort of the tail end of our Oregon chapter that I realized, you know, we've been looking for a different place and not finding it. We had been looking on the coast of California. We'd looked in Northeast Oregon some. But, you know, I really like Vashon Island. I love it. You know, why don't we look there?
And right.
There had been one place that my husband had really been attracted to before we left.
Right.
And at the time, it was before the real estate crash. Mm-hmm. And so it was the price tag was rather high. And mm-hmm. And so that was sort of my last hope for Vashon is like, well, maybe that place isn't sold. And maybe because the economy tanked or the real estate market tanked, you know, maybe we can
right.
move back. Maybe it's available.
Right.
And so I managed to contact the owner who still had it. And she was in a position where she needed to move on. She was going to move out
right
of the country.
On.
And anyway, things worked out.
Boom, bada bang, there
yeah.
you were.
Yeah. So that was, you know, another experience of the magic of Vashon, mm-hmm. which kind of sealed it for me.
Yeah.
So, but we had to be in the Bay Area for family and business reasons mm-hmm. and also waiting for our house to be built. So
right. You know, I love Vashon arrival stories.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, very few people, like, well, when we first moved to Washington, my husband was like, okay, I want to have a house that I own. I don't want to rent. But it was just find a real estate agent. They drive you around some suburbs.
Yeah.
They show you some houses. They're all the same. He actually flew me up here and said, look, I don't really care. You pick the house that you like. Because mm-hmm. I was in college in California at the time. So we went around and there was nothing in the houses to choose from. So, of course, I chose the one that was on a corner lot with the largest yard. And, you know, But there was no reason to be there. You were just getting a house
yeah.
to live in. But Vashon, everyone has a reason. You just don't get here by accident usually,
Yes.
you know? Or so thank you for sharing. I've been sort of wondering a little bit more about that. So currently, my dear, you have a novel titled Because of the Red Fox, a magical nature tale, which is currently in print and being enjoyed by islanders and nature enthusiasts of all ages throughout the Puget Sound region and beyond. You also have this fall, probably November, coming out a comic series that manages to blend kid themes along with herbalism in a way that delights all ages, basically. Wow, you are busy.
Yes, as we all are. Yes.
Very cool. So I'm super happy you came down to the studio to share with us. How about we start off with you telling us a little bit about the book?
Well, Because of the Red Fox is basically an experience of magic in our own world. How maybe the Enchanted Forest is really interwoven with where we are right now. And it's just one adventure into that. So the main character, Shel Wakefield, has just moved to an island that is, for all intents and purposes, Vashon, by another name. And she believes that she's moving there for a particular reason, but then she begins to discover that there is more to that story, more to her own story than she had ever expected, and that she's actually, there are magical things happening all the time, and that her own life is magical, and that she herself has these magical abilities that
So
she's been unconscious of.
So we were talking a little bit about this because currently Julian Hoffman is on my mind because he's doing something very similar, which is really grabbing people's attention all over the world. I mean, when people interact with his work, they are so renewed and excited because what he does is he helps to focus the reader's attention on the details that are so readily missed in our busy lives. I mean, he mostly through a nonfiction way draws our attention back to those things that children tend to notice. The little 3-year-old that squats down in the middle of a parking lot next to 5 blades of grass and a caterpillar that all the adults are just tromping past and is fascinated for 15 minutes while mom is like, come on, honey, can we get going? So he helps to remind us of our ability to see those things in the sort of nonfiction, concrete, real world. It sounds like you're doing something similar to that. But you're bringing magic into the fold.
Yes, and in particular, Shell, and the play, the imaginative play she has with her two cousins who are about her age. It's all of a lot of it is about really like what did we love to do as kids? What did we love to play? And what if those things are actually real? You know, what if what we are inventing or creating is actually part of our world already, or is creating the world, and it is about like noticing what's around us in that child eye with those child eyes. So it's magic eyes, is how Annie, and who's the one of the cousins, refers to it. And I'm hoping it's also an invitation to the reader to do the same, to just put on their child self and those magic eyes, and just like, what is really going on around us? You know, maybe what if it's something quite different than just, you know, driving to work. Maybe, you know, maybe what are those buildings over there? And what about those red cranes over that you can see from the West Seattle Bridge? Are they really cranes or are they dragons? Maybe they're giraffes. I don't know.
Well, and actually, I mean, some people would probably say, well, that's fine, fantasy thinking, blah, blah, blah. But what I find fascinating is that when you go into, you know, deep scientific philosophical perspectives, you know, with what are some of those different theories people are running around with? You know, I mean, there are people who are saying, look, based upon scientific concepts, there's definitely different dimensions. Or there, you know, and then we have movies that'll come out where, you know, you take a completely normal person in our normal world and then something happens. And a lot of them are considered to be actually plausible in a way. So children might find it easier to think outside the box than adults do. But I think that if adults are invited to do so, we don't find it actually so hard ourselves.
Right. Right. And I also like to think about the hero's journey and sort of archetypal ideas and the idea that each one of us has a soul's purpose, a destiny, you know, may as well call it a destiny.
Yeah.
Something, a dream that wants to be lived out in this lifetime. And it's going to be something completely unique to each person. But one way to look at it might be with this child eyes and the realm of fantasy, where maybe it's our superpowers, or maybe it's our magical abilities, or whatever it is. And so that's another hope that I have for the reader, especially older readers, is to kind of take a look at, well, you know, what are my gifts? And are they hidden? And maybe I was more in touch with them as a child. Those things I used to enjoy when in play, imagined play. What if they're really telling me about what I am here on this earth to do?
Right.
And that is incredibly magical when you are actually living your potential. And so that's really, maybe that's my big... one of my big things that I'd like a reader to carry away is just like, what is my treasure that I'm offering?
Yeah. You know, my son and I were just driving home yesterday. He spent the last 2 days working for a friend of mine. So he was really tired, and I'm like, I'll drive you. You don't have to ride your bike. And so we're chatting in the car. Have you ever noticed when you're in the car with your kids or on a bike ride?
Yeah.
If I actually do go bike riding with my kids, which we do a lot, suddenly if I'm quiet, they just start talking about stuff that's been going on. But anyway, so I said, you know, because really if we think about it, there's all these different philosophical or religious beliefs on the planet. And basically every single one of them is intensely magical. I mean, whether you believe in this magical being that created everything, or whether it's reincarnation or whatever, they all deal with powers above and beyond the mundane life that we seem to feel like we're living a lot of times. And then there's the people like Sufi mystics and whatnot who feel that they, in this, quote, mundane world, can reconnect with, you know, that higher power, that whether it's magic or whatever we call it, it's still this idea of a power that's above and beyond the mundane. And so I said to my son something like, you know, wouldn't it be fascinating if, you know, up in, quote, heaven or whatever, you've got souls that sit around and go, well, what do I want to do in my next life? And they look at the world and they're like, okay, I am really good at this. I want to go down and I want to help the world or influence the world in this way. But as soon as they go into the body of the baby, they forget that.
Yeah.
And throughout the life, it's your challenge in a way, or the hope that you will remember or come back into connection with what your goal was, what you came here to do in this life. And my son says, well, that's exactly what I think is going on.
Awesome.
And I was like, oh, okay. And he's like, and I'm just, you know, the world's just so complicated and overwhelming, but I'm just trying to figure out, you know, what I came here to do.
Yeah.
Right. And I thought, wow, like every generation can relate to that concept. And your book is totally written for children. I mean, I'm blown away. You have two beautiful girls, and you wrote this while they were in the age range of the character, and your youngest is still in that age range. I have to say, Jane, you have captured and such an authentic voice in Shell. I mean, I have not had a moment where it felt like an adult was writing this.
Awesome. I'm glad to hear that. And definitely my daughters were a part of the process of creating that book. And I think an early version of the story, Amory said, my older daughter, she said, you know, Shell, she needs more. I don't know. I don't remember the phrase, but she felt that Shell was too boring. And, and so she had some opinions about that. And then I reworked the character. And but I read the story, the various versions of the book aloud to both girls over and over during the years. And reading aloud your own work really brings that you see very clearly where it doesn't work, you hear it. <You're> like, and whoops. Then I had my, you know, my critics there too.
Right.
So, they were definitely part of helping me remember what it is to be a kid. And then just being, and at the time I was homeschooling, so I was around children a lot and around their imaginative play. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the play that I feel like I had, I don't know, a blessing to experience where that managed to find its way into the book too.
Right.
And so just engaging with these kids who are here, especially on the island, they're so themselves and so they were so free to express whatever they were imagining and wanting to do. And mm-hmm. That really, I think, helped to, if it works, if the book works, then I really owe it to being around these great kids.
right. Because our own memory of childhood definitely fades over time if we don't get some reminders.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So let's go ahead. And what I'd like is to have you chat a little bit with us about some of the roles that the various characters mm-hmm. play. Mm-hmm. I definitely want I want my listeners to know that, you know, seriously, you've got a boy or a girl, doesn't matter, because my son is really enjoying the story as well. You have a boy or a girl, I would say anywhere a precocious reader around the age of 9, kids younger who have parents that are willing to read to them, or all the way up into, you know, even adults. Like, you know, as a parent, when you're going to read to a child, it's just gravy if you actually enjoy the story as well, you know?
Yes.
And this is one that I think the adults will enjoy as well. So I just really want to encourage people to consider this as a recommendation or a gift for a young person in their life, because I am writing personally a new adult or a young adult. So I'm constantly researching what's out there on the shelves. And almost everything that's out there on the shelves comes from the perspective of a very human-centric, societal-focused, and oftentimes a lot of it is from the school perspective, which is fine if you're going for school reality. But if you want a vacation from that, and like a summer vacation to an island somewhere, like kids used to go see grandma and grandpa and spend the summer on the island, this book sort of encapsulates a vacation from the mainstream world and a chance to see the world through different eyes.
Yes.
And so I really hope people will go check this out. And tell us a little bit. You've already talked a little bit about Shell. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Shell's parents? Because I think they have some surprises up their sleeves.
Yeah, they are. Her father is someone in the computer world, corporate world, and he's doing his job. And her mother is an herbalist, and also she makes quilts and story dolls, and that seem to have a life of their own. That's what the people say who buy them and all that. But these two people, even though they love each other, they live apart. And Shell has just always accepted that she lives with one parent for a number of years, and then she goes to live with another parent. And she doesn't ever question this arrangement they have. And, you know, in a world where there are many different kinds of living arrangements, that works. But this is a time when she's supposed to be living with her mother and moving off to Wales, you know, so across the ocean. That's where her mother lives, is in Wales. and that doesn't happen. And in the course of real, and she ends up moving up to our island instead with her dad and being with their family there. And she loves that, but then she's, because of this red fox, this connection with the red fox and the possibility of it, it opens this doorway to, well, wait a minute, what really is going on with her parents? Why do they live apart? And maybe there's more to their lives than Shell has been realizing. And then of course that leads to, well, maybe there's more in her life to her life and her true magic than she ever even started questioning about. And so it's sort of like that soul story you were talking about, you know, souls, in one level, it might be read that way, where it's, you know, she has one life that she's unconscious to, and then she wakes up to it as, coming into adolescence.
Absolutely. It's that age where you start to
Think
a little bit differently.
Yeah.
And ask certain questions.
Yes. And then, of course, then there's a question of like, why did my parents decide this? And why did they think that was a good idea anyway? I don't think it's a good idea that they chose this. So anyway, that's...
Right. So the parents are...
Parents.
Yeah, they've definitely got some interesting things going on. And now, currently, I'm raising boys. You have girls. I have boys. My boys are teen and preteen years, smack dab in the middle of them suckers. And they're really, it's fascinating to see them embroiled in the social circle other kids going through the same ages. And them all trying to figure out the world. See, like for me, I moved constantly in my childhood. So I never really spent more than 6 to 9 months in any one place until later in high school. And then I was sort of like, I'd be somewhere for 9 months and then I'd go see my mom for the summer and my dad would move again. And then I'd go see my mom for the summer and my dad would move again. And it was always like a new place. So I have found it fascinating the impact that the peers upon children at this age. Because I never really had peer impact because I never stuck around long enough to have that. So Shell has some cousins that are on this island, and it seems that they are playing a very powerful role in her life as well. Why don't you tell us a little bit about her cousins?
Okay. So Shell has two cousins, Annie, who's the younger cousin, a year younger than Shell. So Annie's 11. And then Santa, her full name is Samantha, but she's called Santa, and she's 13. Mm-hmm. And Shell has moved next door to them. So Santa is very opinionated. She likes to have plans, detailed plans on how to do things. And she's very, you know, like even, but she's also kind of, nervous about going into the world. So like even walking downtown into a four-way stop where there's no traffic lights and trying to navigate crossing a street is a real challenge to her. Mm-hmm. And so she just spends a lot of time plotting things out. And when the things don't go according to plan, then it throws her off and she gets kind of spastic.
And there's definitely people like that in the world.
Yes. And she's very idealistic as well. She's the cousins live in this, in a neighborhood farm community that's trying to move towards sustainability. Mm-hmm. And so to support each other as a community. And so she's very, you know, she wants to support that. She wants them to have probably zero waste and, you know, do as much locally and support the local businesses. So she's got a lot of ideals. And she also is fascinated by technology. And so she's kind of, you know, like we all are, kind of a mixed person.
Right.
And then her cousin Annie, I mean, Santa's sister Annie.
Right.
Shell's cousin is pretty much the opposite end of the spectrum. She's very much of a fairy child, and she's very happy to play with dolls and hear them talk to her and, you know, make tea for them and imagine that there are wild teapots running in the forest. And, you know, her big dream is to open up a tea stand for pilgrims, and she wants to walk the Camino de Santiago or at least map it onto the island of herself and walk it in her own neighborhood. And so, you know, she's kind of got this mystical side to her.
Right.
And so there's that mystical and then this very, well, you know, what's in front of my face is what's real. And and Santa herself says, well, there's, you know, nobody's ever seen a red fox on the island. There aren't foxes on the island. And
right.
You know, it's like, well, why can't they be? You know, we get bears here. We have deer here. Coyotes are here. Why can't there be foxes too?
Right.
So
that, you know, it's funny because when you're mentioning some of that, what suddenly came to mind, which had not before, and I think it's still a going trend, but when I came to the island, there was all this talk about and books being written about making those fairy houses. I'm sure, I bet your girls did that. But do you remember the idea that you'd go out? And I think I did that with my kids. Totally. I remember now they did with their friend Xander. I think they built a nice place and then they would like go out and they'd leave little gifts for the fairies. They would decorate it for the fairies.
Yeah.
So there's a whole, obviously, given that those ideas are written and published by adults and fostered by adults, there's a real desire in our culture to instill imaginative, you know, thinking in our children, to allow them to believe in more than just that mundane world. There's a lot of that out there. There's a lot of people.
Yeah,
who are
absolutely
seeking that.
Yes. And your story about making the fairy houses, you know, you did that outside, right?
Right.
You know, and so part of all this, I feel, of capturing the magic of childhood is to have the magic of nature as part of the story. Mm-hmm. Nature is part of the story. The natural world is also a character in the book, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Right.
And that it's natural for us as human beings to engage with nature in a way that's playful.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of our coming into relationship with the natural world and growing in to be skilled in the natural world, having to communicate with the natural mm-hmm. world. And that in itself becomes wondrous when mm-hmm. you go wandering into the forest and you're aware of what's going on around you and you see something really strange and remarkable. Like I saw a tree breathing one day where mm-hmm. it was an apple tree and there was this gray thing in a hole in the tree and it was going back and forth. And I realized, wow, I think there's a raccoon sleeping in the hollow. The tree is hollow,
wow.
And a raccoon's sleeping in there.
That's, you know, amazing.
It's astounding. And so one thing I really hope of anybody reading my book is that not only are we come back to our imaginative selves. It's like, oh, hey, you know, there's power in there for me to mm-hmm. explore my imagination and explore it in the real world, so mm-hmm. quote unquote, but also to go back to our relationship with the natural world and say, hey, you know, this is really remarkable that we're here on this planet and there's all kinds of things going on all around us, just mm-hmm. outside our doors. And well, even in our houses, you know, with mm-hmm. the spiders and the flies doing their thing, you know, and they're all these beings, these that are like alien beings to most of us, maybe all of us,
because we either take them for granted or we dismiss them or we forget to notice.
Yeah, exactly. And there are magical creatures themselves. There is this wonderful, wonderful video I saw on the internet. It was an interview with Michael Pollan, who wrote Botany of Desire.
Right.
And he wrote an article.
And Omnivore's Dilemma, too?
Yes.
Yes.
And I think in January or maybe December, he wrote an article that was published in The New Yorker about plant intelligence.
Oh, nice.
And so on I think it's variously in various places on the web.
Right.
But there is a video about where it's a video of a plant with time-lapse photography. It's a bean plant. And the bean plant is casting out tendrils to reach a pole to climb up. And it's like watching a fisherman casting a line as it tries again and again. And its leaves go up and down almost like wings. It's you can see it actually moving and struggling and to reach this pole and climb around it.
And how does it know the pole is
exactly,
there?
Exactly, exactly.
Because it wasn't going in other directions where there were no
poles,
right?
Exactly.
It knew the pole was there and it was reaching for it over and over.
Yeah.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Because you would think it would just be shooting off in all random directions, but it wasn't?
It wasn't. No, it knew that the pole was there and that pole was like 2 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
And so there, you know, so there we go. You know, this is the wonderful thing about science right now is that we are encountering really remarkable, mind-bending experiences of what's really outside our door.
And if we didn't have the ability to do that type of time-lapse photography, we would have just gone on thinking that they just happened to, by accident, find the pole.
Exactly. Yeah. Whereas you can see this plant really struggling and then reaching it and then relaxing.
Oh.
And then there's another part of the video where there's two plants reaching for the same pole. And when one reaches that pole, the other one gives up on that and starts casting in a different direction, doesn't find anything. And then it's really very sad. It gives up.
Oh,
so sad. I hope they gave it a pole at the end of the video.
I know. Poor thing.
Exactly. So,
so they didn't compete.
No, they didn't compete.
Now, you know the story about Beatrice Potter and her scientific side. Yes.
Why don't you refresh our
So I love this. Every time there is a scientific issue that comes up where the current common knowledge or the current beliefs are A, and someone says, well, maybe there's a B going on, and the A people say, no, there can't be a B because there's A, and we know there's A, and we are confident in A, there's no B. Right? Mm-hmm. Every time that comes up, I say, what about Beatrice Potter? People go, huh? You know, she wrote little stories about rabbits and stuff. Okay. But she also was a massive naturalist and an incredible artist. And she did unbelievable scientific research, really, of the natural world, everything from funguses to lichen. And I'm pretty sure it's lichen, not moss. This is lichen because for example, our island is covered in Usnea, which is this lichen that grows all over the trees. And Usnea is two creatures living together symbiotically.
Yes.
And about 120 or 140 or whatever, you know, years ago when she was in her life in the late 1800s, the scientific world of Europe, and I can't say the world, I can't, the scientific thinking of Europe, so white, male-dominated European thinking at the time, was that the whole world was based upon competition. And they had pretty much decided that symbiotic relationships were not possible, did not exist, and were not around. It was all competition. So she came to this community as a white female, right? And she said, you know, these two creatures are actually living together symbiotically. All over the world, they work together. And they blew her off. They like she went to talk to one person who was the head of a scientific community and at a university and all this. And I think she was allowed into the office. And while she laid out her drawings and explained what she had discovered, he basically wouldn't even look at her, ignored her and said, okay, you can go now. I mean, so she was completely dismissed. And then she went on and continued to explore the natural world and to capture all this amazing information. About 100 years later, that same scientific organization held a banquet party type of thing, you know, in her honor to celebrate and acknowledge that she had been 100% correct, that they had not been willing to listen to her or learn from her at the time, and that she was completely accurate in her findings. And they celebrated this, you know, long after she had passed, of course. So, you know, it's like most of us would just assume you go out in a garden and you're like, oh, yeah, those beans are battling over territory or they're, you know, or they this bean's so silly. It's going the wrong direction. I got to push it over here because it doesn't know where to go. You got to help because they're just dumb plants or whatever. And now with this photography, someone was able to show something completely different.
Yeah.
So anytime we are like, it's AAA, it's like, you know what? A is accurate to a point, but there's B and there's C and there's D, and we just haven't found them yet.
Exactly.
We've got to keep our minds open and keep.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm going to Google that later.
Yeah, do it.
Oh, I'm so excited. In fact, when I find that, if I can, I'll see if I can actually put a link to it on my prose, poetry, and purpose link that I have, you know, my little page that I have on Voice of Vashon, and I'll see if I can maybe link to that.
That would be great.
If I can pull that off.
Yeah, because, you know, just when I watch that, I feel like, you know, magical creatures are all around us.
Right.
You know, so look at your fly, that fly on your window. A different light.
I know. What is that fly doing? Right now, there's the whole thing going on with, you know, the questions around neonics, which is the short term for, I believe, nicotine-based chemicals that are being used that are causing so much trouble for all the bees in the world, right? And I, as this conversation has come to the island and we've been talking about it, I've started stopping more and more often when I walk past a group of plants that have flowers on them. And I either stop because I go, wait a minute, there's like, recently I was in town and there's a spot with like 30 different flowering plants, zero bees.
Yes.
And I didn't understand why. And then I was at Lincoln Park and I walked up to this beautiful purple plant that has these big, bald, spiked things that have little flowers all over. There was a bee festival happening on that plant. It was covered. And so I'm stopping now.
Yeah.
And I'm noticing the pollinators, whatever type of bees they are.
Right.
Or their absence. It's like it's raised my awareness.
Yes. Yeah, I'm starting to pay attention to and noticing that there aren't a lot of honeybees that I've been seeing.
Right. And I think your novel brings awareness to a myriad number of things in our world. Mm-hmm. And at the end of reading it, that kids and adults alike are going to have had their eyes opened mm-hmm. again in mm-hmm. certain ways.
Yeah, I hope so. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I like to end my interview mm-hmm. with a question for my authors, because prose, poetry, and purpose is based upon the idea that most people who write have a hope for what their reader will take away.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in particular, most of the people that I interview, they are looking within themselves and writing about reasons for having hope.
Mm-hmm,
because
mm-hmm.
right now, so many of our young people that are coming into their adulthood are a little bit shocked
yes.
and possibly have a tendency towards just feeling defeated before they've even
yes.
started, because they're our generation and our parents' generation in particular. Those two generations had the ability to really know what was going on
yes.
and to make changes in behavior and lifestyle. And we pretty much chose not to make very many changes. And now it is coming down the pipe, all of the mm-hmm. consequences mm-hmm. of our actions and our parents' actions. And in particular, it's coming really fast,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, astronomical growth in the problems mm-hmm. that were predicted. They're hitting us faster and harder than we had maybe imagined or been willing
right.
to acknowledge. So a lot of young people are just in shock.
Yes.
And I'm wondering what reasons you would give to your daughters, to my children, and to all of the people who read your novel or your lovely comic series coming out in November. What reasons for hope would you give to young people right
yeah.
now as they face the world the way it is?
Well, for one thing, the natural world is incredibly resilient and always trying new things. It's very diverse. It's abundant. Even with whatever we do to it, it's amazing how quickly the natural world can restore itself if given the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And we can find examples of that resiliency anywhere, pretty much anywhere we are, I would say. Maybe knock on wood. That's true. But for a young person to just find those wild places or feral places, and that doesn't have to be very far from where you are. It can be
mm-hmm.
right outside your door. It can be the place where the dandelions keep busting through the concrete, you know, despite
mm-hmm.
all the pesticides, the chemicals and things that people want to put on them. You know,
right.
there is and that resilience of the natural world is something that, well, it's part of us. We are part of the natural world. As human
mm-hmm.
beings, we are an outbreath of that. And maybe even some people like to talk about how we are the dream of the earth, part of the dream of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And that dream includes everything around us, all the more than human world. And so the more we can kind of open our eyes and our experience to just a simple nature around us, then I think it becomes very easy to connect to the wonder and the exuberance that is there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just really encourage anybody and certainly young people to just find a place to be alone with nature, however that is, even if there are people around you, but someplace where you can have your own experience of the natural world and yourself within it.
Right.
Because that's where you, not that you can't find this anywhere else, but it's where your unique abilities and imagination and intellect, whatever is unique about you as a human being will come alive when you have a natural connection
right.
with whatever, you know, the more than human world.
Right.
So finding that, it's pretty, you know, it's right there. You
yeah.
don't have to go to school for that. Maybe we
right.
don't want to go to school for that. I don't know.
Right.
But just taking that time to be with it and then go on that journey of adventure, because it is an adventurous journey.
That's excellent. It's like so well said. And the only addition I would make
mm-hmm.
to that idea is that when a person reconnects to the mm-hmm. more than human world, we start to realize that our life can be filled with value that is not human-centric, because the yes. problem behaviors that we have are oftentimes how we live within that bubble of humanity. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, the person who goes out and hikes, you know, yeah. for 3 weeks and eats the foods that are wildly abundant and you know, carries their trash out very little. And, you know, that person just spent 3 weeks not like treading softly.
Yes.
Compared to yeah. 3 weeks of, you know, I'm going to get in a plane and I'm going to fly to three different mm-hmm. cities and I'm going to mm-hmm. go on tour buses and I'm going to eat out of fancy restaurants and I'm going to buy tourism gadgets that were made in China, you know, and that 3 week behavior mm-hmm. would have a heavy print mm-hmm. on the planet.
Right. Right.
And I think we're more inclined to do that mm-hmm. if we're only living in that bubble. But when we start mm-hmm. to remember how exciting the natural world is, mm-hmm. suddenly mm-hmm. walking softly becomes a lot easier.
Exactly. And when you're connected to the nature, when you love what's outside your own door, mm-hmm. There is, in herbalism, it's like it's considered the most powerful herbal medicines are the ones that are right outside your door. You know, there's right. a relationship that happens that really springs alive and is vitalizing and nourishing on a variety of levels. I would also want to include that in going out to be with the natural world and experience it as its own, I don't know, being, magical mm-hmm. creature, mm-hmm. whatever, that when you do it with other people in community, you know, whether it's a small, you know, another person who's having that adventure at the same time, or a small group of people or a larger, then that is pretty darn exciting too.
Right.
And so that's, you know, what I also sort of dream for all of us, is that we restore or renew our relationship with the natural world and our, you know, citizenship maybe.
Right.
And also grow that in a community, because when we, and that itself nourishes the community and how we care about each other and how we live truly with each other and, I don't know,
right.
and make the decisions that you're talking about of taking different, you know, actions and
right.
treading a little bit more lightly, because we're considering, we can see, we have the experience of cause and effect.
Right.
We know what happens when we sit in one place.
Right.
Or tread on a yeah. little delicate plant.
Right, right, mm-hmm. exactly. And I think your novel is just such a great door that people can open, you know, mm-hmm. upon a whole bunch of different ways of living, thinking, feeling, and enjoying mm-hmm. life.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks. Jane, thanks so much.
Thank you, March.
Yeah, this has been awesome. And I'll see you at Farmer's Market.
Yes.
And also, everyone who has questions for you and wants to talk to you directly or learn more about your harping. And I'm a big fan of Anne McCaffrey,
oh,
so
yes.
I love it that you're a Harper. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I would love to go to Harper Hall with you, wouldn't you? Like,
you know, I'm a member of a society called Harper's Hall and Culinary Society. Yeah, it's a harp organization
Yay.
In California. Anyway,
well, so people can learn more about your music and about your novel, and they can connect with you at Forest Halls, all one word, .org.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, I have a contact form there and a blog, and yeah, come visit me.
Excellent. All right. There you go. We're done.
All right.
Yay.
Okay. Thanks, Marge.
Ooh, except we're not done. So Jane, you've got a small little section from your novel that you're going to read for us today.
Yes. This is when Shell and her cousins have gone to a bookshop in downtown Seattle. It's called the Inside Bay Bookshop, and had a disturbing encounter where she saw her father in a mysterious light, put it that way. Right. So the cousins trooped out the side door and up the steps. Oh, got to call Mom, Santa muttered, yanking forth her handy talkie. WB6RIU, this is N6SEM. We are leaving the cafe and heading to a new destination. I repeat, we are heading to a new unplanned destination. We hear that a chicken shop has opened in Explorer Plaza. That's where we're headed. Oh, yes, that's Aunt Jan. By all means, go there. Be sure to tell me all about it. What? You act like you've heard about this shop. Well, of course. And you didn't tell us? Santa was all outrage. Even though we've talked and planned for ages about raising chickens, I figured you'd stumble across it on your way to the Undertown tour. I wanted the chicken shop to be a surprise. But just go there. Call me again when you leave. WB6RRU monitoring. N6SEM clear. Jamming the handy talkie into her day pack, Santa strode forward. The next instant, she bugged her eyes and stared, rotating her head this way and that. Now what are you doing? Shell exclaimed. Allies, Santa said crisply. Deer ears, and, she gave a slight humph, foxwalk. You both should do the same. Remember, awareness. We're in the city. There are predators here. And supervillains, Annie chirped. Immediately, she adopted her sister's awareness attitude, though minus the bug eyes, slipping into a soft focus gaze and a gliding walk. With a sigh, Shell followed suit. She widened her vision to include the many and diverse passers-by, the cars and buses in motion, and opened her hearing to the myriad sounds around. She relaxed into a secretive and nimble stride. Proceeding with traffic, the cousins crossed the street. In another block. Huh, Santa frowned. Look at those women in those brocaded gowns, those men in doublets and leggings and fancy shoes. Maybe some kind of festival is taking place after all. Maybe it's a special celebration day, grandparents of all of us day, baby, or... I like the ladies in those bodices and long skirts, Annie said. They look like they could be from a British countryside from years and years past. They passed a cobbled street lined with slate-roofed, stone-built homes. That's new, Santa said. You mean old, Annie said. The houses look super-duper old. Whatever. Anyway, it's got to be new construction. I've never noticed anything like that street around here before. Shell's stomach churned. The cousins passed what appeared to be a pub. It was labeled with a wooden sign displaying a man's face made of leaves. The face held a noble expression. A carved circlet adorned the image like a simple crown. Shell lurched to a stop. We're Arglwood. Annie attempted to sound out the words on the sign. We're Arglwood. What kind of jumbled language is that? Santa scowled. Shell's heart hammered. It's Welsh, I think. She fished for the pronunciations of those words, drilled into her by her dad at some point so that she could make sense of place names on their map of Wales. We're Arglwydd. It's pronounced something like that. And there's the name in English, Annie pointed to where the Welsh name, if that's what it was painted on a window with English words below. The Green Lord. What a lovely surprise, she continued, cheerful. We're on a pilgrimage. It's just like my Camino idea. What are you talking about? Santa demanded. You know, Annie stretched her arms, my idea of imagining a big place from far away just showing up right where we are, but in a squeezed-up form. Someday I'll map the 500-mile journey that is the Camino de Santiago onto yonder's highways. But right now it looks like we're on our own pilgrimage, maybe a mini one. Aunt Ellen's country is moving in. Santa did not deign to answer. Shoving her hands in her pockets, she resumed her march. As Annie scampered to catch up with her sister, Shell's eye was caught by something in the pub window. For a moment, she seemed to glimpse a parade of red and white colors in rippling patterns, speckled, striped, curlicued. She blinked. No, she'd been seeing things. Before her, in the glass, sat a lanky young man and a white-haired, white-bearded man. In some trick of the reflected light, the older man appeared huge in stature, the height and breadth of a small tree. He wore a leather jerkin and had a kindly eye. The young man, dressed in forest green and whose hair and skin seemed similar in colors to Shell's, drooped his head into his arms. The older man glanced in Shell's direction. Their gaze met. Shell's jaw dropped. Did she know him? It felt like she did. The next instant, something shifted in the window reflection. The table was empty.
I thought I heard a baby cry this morning. I thought I heard a baby cry today. You didn't get no baby cry this morning. You didn't hear no baby cry today. Where have all the people gone, my honey? About all those people, you never see those people anyway. I thought I heard a young man mourn this morning. I thought I heard a young today. I thought I heard a young man mourn this morning. I can't walk out in the morning dew today. In the morning, do today.